Thank you so much for listening to The Cast of Us, the show for people that love guns and emotions here on the Incomparable Network. I'm Brian Hamilton, and I'm joined by Tiff Arment. Good morning to you, Tiff.
Good morning. Oh, man, that was a rough night.
Your birthday recently, and I bet you had a very fun celebration and then even more fun Last of Us watching afterwards, right?
Well, actually, for my birthday, I got a PS5. What? So I am ready to play the remastered version of this game, and I'm very excited.
And the other person on this podcast that has also been playing the remastered version is Ben McCarthy. Good afternoon, Ben, all the way over there in GMT land.
Hello, fellow survivalists.
When we, first of all, I want to throw out there that yesterday, as we record this, Anna Wershing, who played Tess in the game, she passed away at the age of 45 from cancer, which is absolutely wild to me. I am so sad that, 10 years after the game and right when the show is airing on HBO, she has passed away. We send our best wishes to her family.
Yeah, very sad. Oh, remarkable man. Coincidence of timing.
So season one, episode three, Long, Long Time. We pull the title of this episode from a very important song we're about to hear a little bit later. No cold open this week, just straight into the credits. And then we roll over to 10 miles west of Boston, where Joel is in a creek building rocks into a little stack. Did you know what he was doing here? I didn't catch what that was.
That's like a trail marking thing. It has a name and I can't think of it. Ben, do you know the name of what that is?
No, I just think of them as little rock stacks. But anyway, I was wondering if it was like a little gravestone for Tess, perhaps.
It could have been. It usually, it's like a marking in the wood of like, oh, I've been here, or it has a name. And people are probably screaming right now about what the name is. But a lot of environmentalists actually say don't do this because it like messes up ecosystems and kills slugs or something. I'm not sure. But
rock cairns.
There it is. People build them for all kinds of reasons.
And I bet there's a little bit less pushback on them in, post-apocalyptic Boston than there is now. But yes, 100%. If you are out there in the wild west of Boston and you want to build little rock cairns yourself, definitely do some research into why you should not. Ellie is wrapped up in Joel's coat, which Instagram has been advertising very, very heavily to me. The company that made Joel's coat, I guess, realized they were in the show and has been doing a massive advertising push. I wanted to ask Ben, Tiff, have you gotten Instagram ads for Joel's coat?
I haven't. No. But I have gotten Instagram ads for Wednesday's backpack. So, I'm pretty close. I feel like maybe one more week and I'm going to get one.
Ben, are you saying any?
No Instagram ads for coats or merchandise. I never interact with them, so Instagram is my ads are just all over the place.
I also never interact with them, but it looks like Huckberry, number one flannel-lined waxed trucker jacket going into the show notes, is the jacket that Joel wears in the entirety of the show, and I keep getting ads for it. That's great.
Oh, well, I'm a consumer whore, so I interact with everything.
And how? Ellie's trying to engage with Joel, and Joel's giving her the cold shoulder in the aftermath of Tess dying, quote-unquote, because of her. This is part of where we're starting to see the fallout of everything that happened in Boston last week. We had a whole week of fallout for us to, process everything that happened. Joel, in this moment, that must have happened, a day or two before in real life to him. And he keeps giving Ellie the cold shoulder. Ellie is just like me in that we want to address the elephants in the room ASAP, which tells Joel to not blame her for something that isn't her fault, which, frankly, is true. This performance in Bella Ramsey is great. Tiff, what'd you think of it?
I really like this scene. I like that it's setting up kind of what just happened. They have to address it, and Ellie wants to put it out there, and we need to see that there is tension between these two, because honestly, as the episode moves on, we don't see them that much. So this is kind of our connection to the previous episode, this moment with them in the woods. Joel does give her some kindness, and he throws his rations over to her because I guess she finished her big meaty sandwich that she was chowing down on before. This is like one of those moments where we are going to be gradually seeing the two of them have to travel together. And, Joel sets some ground rules here, and Ellie is forced to follow them because they're stuck together now, and it's just the two of them.
Yeah, I think from this point forward, there's kind of nobody else around. So they are interacting more and they are building up more of a relationship. So I think this is kind of the turning point, you know, the end of the coldness between them.
You would think that after 20 years in the zombie apocalypse, Joel should know by now what is and isn't people's fault. And the way I read this scene is that this, like, seasoned veteran of the, you know, post-apocalyptic wasteland is kind of being reactivated emotionally by this young girl that he's projecting, you know, feelings about his daughter onto. And I guess for the first time, he's really starting to not have this sense of, I don't even want to say frontier justice, but kind of like apocalypse justice, where he realizes, oh, okay, if we're going out on this mission, things are going to happen. It can't be anyone's specific fault because nature doesn't care about us as humans. But I think he's being reactivated for the first time about how this technically is not Ellie's fault, but he feels like it is, because if it weren't for her, nothing would have happened with Tess. He wouldn't be out west of Boston. He wouldn't have to, you know, fare in this, you know, western area. It just makes me feel very conflicted about how Joel's approaching the situation, but as we know from playing the game, hopefully he grows as the time in the series goes on.
I think as well, he's, you know, he's been emotionally closed off for the last 20 years, and really the only person who has made a chink in that armor has been Tess, who is now gone. So I think he is, you know, very defensive, or especially closed off at this point, just feeling wounded.
They keep walking down for a 5-hour-long hike to get to Bill's place. Ellie asks, are there any infected? No? Okay, then what are we looking out for? People. Once again, reiterating the idea that we have people in the world that are just as dangerous, if not more so, than the zombies, because zombies cannot build tripwires. Are Bill and Frank nice? Well, Frank is. I thought that was very funny rewatching the episode this morning, how Joel feels about Frank versus Bill, because, of course, Bill is a little bit colder and Frank is a lot warmer. And then we have a scene of Ellie kind of interrogating Joel about his scar. This scene reminded me a lot of the scene in Hot Fuzz where Nick Frost goes, oh, have you ever fired a gun into the air and screamed, ah, because we have Ellie thinking that something traumatic that happened to Joel was really, really cool because he has a scar from it. Ben, what'd you think?
Nice little bit of interaction. Again, kind of this is them just ever so slightly starting to warm up to each other. Joel is still kind of cagey about his history, I suppose. Maybe it's not especially intentional, but he doesn't really want to share himself. But I love Ellie's curiosity. It's the first time that she's been in the world, you know, outside of her orphanage, school, military complex, outside the walls. Everything is just fresh and new to her.
Ellie's a teaser, you know. She likes to pick at people and make fun of them and throw a whole bunch of shade and try and, you know, I feel like she might have grown up in the 90s where criticizing is a form of affection. You know what I mean? Like, she makes all these jokes about his scar, like, oh, are you bad at using a gun? You know, so, but it's almost one of those things that you do when you're really young and you haven't had the accidental, oh no, I said the wrong thing in my joke and actually hit a really sensitive nerve in someone's life, and I should probably be more careful about that later. It's like you learn that the hard way as you go through life. I remember once I made a your mom joke to someone whose mom passed away, and I was like, I will never do that again. Lesson learned. I was a totally terrible person, and now I understand that that is an off limits thing. You know what I mean? Like, this is where Ellie is at, and she is essentially making the your mom joke to Joel here about his scar, and we know that that scar was from the night his daughter died, and Ellie doesn't, and Joel is not going to be revealing that anytime soon to her, but we see the pain in his face, and we know that Ellie is soon going to learn better, but for right now she's still, you know, kind of poking the bear a bit.
They come around to a Cumberland Farms, which is an American kind of convenience store chain. Ben, have you ever been to a Cumberland Farms?
Don't believe so.
When that came on screen, Trudge and I both shouted and cheered, for that is our hometown convenience store in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, respectively. I thought that was very funny and a cool way of showing kind of the deterioration of the world. Ellie gets drawn to a Mortal Kombat 2 machine, which I thought was very, very fun. It was great to see her be a little kid and freak out about characters that, I forget what it was, chew up someone and spit out their bones. And oh my God, isn't that so cool? Very fun moment of Ellie. I think she'd be an excellent incomparable panelist.
I like her connection here with the games like that, because in the actual game, she really likes the comic books. I think they might have touched on that in the show, too.
There is an arcade briefly. Machine as well that she's drawn to, because well, I think she and Riley play it in the mall.
Yes, that's right.
That's
right.
Behind
right.
I just
is it
love
the same
that.
Machine?
It's I think, like a made-up game, knives something. It's like a character with knives for fists.
I just love that connection to, like, build out her as a character and what she likes, and that she doesn't like the typical girl stuff. You know, like, now we know that everyone is much more broad than their gender, obviously, but at the time of this game, and I think a lot of people watching a TV show, like, that is such a great small thing to keep adding into her character, that like she's not who you think she is, and I like that they are building her out as like more than in many different ways, and they do that in these subtle things like the video game. I mean, even how adventurous she is in this scene where Joel is looking for his stash, she again makes fun of him for not being able to find it, and then she jumps down this hole in the back room that she finds. I mean, okay, good on you, Elle, for like flopping over that trash can to make sure you do have a way out. I appreciated that. Like, you know, the video game player in me is like, you gotta look for the way out. Like, what are you doing? You can't do that. But she does do that, and I think that that's really cool that they set that up. But man, the guts to just jump down a dirty dark hole. I mean, I guess she had a reward down there, though, a big payoff of finding a box of tampons, which I was like, yes, let's normalize periods. Thank you. Yeah. I love that she found those.
Of course, Joel would think that the place was combed over and Ellie finds something that would not be in Joel's radar at all, which is tampons. I also had in my notes that she dragged the garbage can under the thing, too. I need to stop reading every time a character moves something as a reference to video games in general, but until I do, I still feel very fan-serviced by this. Like, yeah, this is a video game. We get to see people doing what we got to do as players of The Last of Us.
Or at least just a thoughtful survivalist, you know? You don't jump down into a hole that you can't get back up unless you set something up to get back up. You know? I don't know.
Isn't that a
like
U2 song,
sense.
Stuck in a Hole You Can't Get Out Of?
Stuck in a Moment.
I know.
Moment, hole, so close.
It is a great little scene for her, though, because you're really getting a sense that, you know, she kind of wants to be a little bit independent. Maybe she resists the idea of having, like, these caretakers watching over her. You know, she wants to explore. She's sort of excited by the danger, I suppose. And then she goes into this hole. She finds her tampons looting around the shelves, as we love to do. And then she sees this infected buried under the rubble. And there's like this gleam in her eye or something. She's like, oh, here's a situation where I'm in control. I have the upper hand. And she just kind of sidles over to this infected who is looking horrific, all crushed and mushrooms pouring out of his face. And then she takes out her knife and just cuts the skin open, and we see our favorite body horror of the fungus or whatever underneath the skin.
Mm-mm-mm.
It kind of just looks like stuffing, like they're teddy bears or something like that, but
yeah,
much more
stuffing.
Biological.
That's it. It's just stuffing.
And then, of course, she just stabs it in the head, as you do. But there's just something about her expression and her mannerisms here that it's like, it's not quite that she's getting a sick pleasure out of it, but there's something going on there more than just taking one out for the team.
She's super curious. You know, I think she's curious about being that close to infected. But also she had mentioned earlier in the show, she asked Joel, like, you know, how many of you killed, or have you killed one before? Or, you know, she was very curious about that, and I think that she was testing herself here of if she could do it and how human it might have felt, you know, to to address this infected? Like, because that was another thing she brought up. She was like, you know, is it, you know, comparative to like killing a human? You know, am I remembering that correctly? Right. Like she brought this
up.
I think
so.
And so I think like right now in this situation, just like you said, Ben, like she's in control here. So she's not afraid, but she is extremely curious. And I think she's testing herself at like, what are her limits? Like, what is she capable of? Like if she gets put into a situation, could she do it? I mean, she keeps asking for a gun every single chance she gets. She's looking to have a firearm because she's like, I can hold my own. And it's almost like in this basement by herself, she was putting herself to the test of like, could I hold my own? You know, obviously it's not running at her right now, so she had the advantage, but at the same time she did do it, and she walked away from that situation, and she didn't tell Joel. You know, she didn't mention it. She more like she took care of it and then moved on. And I think that that was a test for herself.
I think as well, presumably her whole life up until this point has been in the context of, you know, the outside world is a scary, dangerous place, and there are bad people and there are monsters out there. And now she's out in it, and she kind of has to find her place in this world. You know, is she a survivor? Is she a killer? Is she just cargo for Joel? And so, you know, as a 14-year-old kid or whatever, she is curious, just really trying to work out her role, I guess.
With Chernobyl fresh on the mind, I'm thinking about the episode where we have that kind of extra character learning to go out and shoot the animals that were over-radiated by Chernobyl. And there's a lot in that particular episode, because this kid's a newbie. He's never held a gun before. He's never done anything like that. And the kind of humanity of, oh, you are a changed person once you have killed someone or something. And then you realize, no, that's always been me. It's always been inside me. It's just came out now because I've had to kill someone or something. And I think for Craig Mazin, it must be a fun, interesting writing exercise to write someone like Ellie, who doesn't really approach death in that way, because she's been, you know, I was born in it, molded by it, because she was born after the apocalypse. And the way that she approached kind of trying to kill a zombie for the first time since, you know, meeting Joel, it felt like self-discovery in a way, but also didn't seem to F her up at all, because she goes and sees Joel and like, hey, guess what? I found some tampons, and moves on very quickly. She didn't seem very impacted by it, but maybe she was happy about it and just hiding it from Joel.
I think it made her feel stronger. You know, I think it gave her that confidence of like, maybe I could do this if I needed to.
She could if she needs to, but she's also in a position where I don't know if she wants to or not, but she wants to be prepared at the very least for it.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Like a prepper, perhaps.
Oh, very nice. They keep walking, and Jolie. Well, I can't cut this now. This is too funny. Joel and Ellie find a plane, and Ellie wonders about, you know, what it was like to fly up in the air in one of those things. It's so cool. You're up in the sky. She takes things for granted, or she finds wonder in things that we in the 2023 watching audience take for granted, and things that Joel's very cynical about. Wasn't all that great. You're shoved into a metal tube, and you pay $12 for a sandwich. I thought that was a very funny moment of, you know, again, them clashing.
Sandwich humor.
Sandwich humor is my favorite kind of humor, especially in HBO, where you never actually see sandwich humor very, very often, which leads them to a conversation about how did it all start at once? And we talked a lot about this last week when we saw these scenes in Jakarta. Do people actually know how this began? And Joel says, well, we know a few things. We can kind of guess that what came from a staple ingredient like flour or sugar or pancake mix. And he calls out pancake mix specifically. Ben, I thought of you exactly in that moment. Mm-hmm.
It's nice that, you know, they've got a pretty good idea of what it was, but society and information has kind of collapsed, so they're probably never going to know for sure.
Of all the things, I was a little surprised that Ellie didn't know this stuff already. I mean, I understand why it needed to be here. It's like, hey, we need to tell the audience, like, give them a little bit more information, because now we didn't get any of those flashbacks in the beginning. You know, like you said, we just kind of started it. So I think the science now of why all those questions are answered officially after this interaction between Joel and Ellie kind of recapping what happened. And I think that the most impactful part of this, though, is as they're walking down the road, Joel wants to take a detour, but because he doesn't want Ellie to see something that's up ahead. And it ends up being a mass grave, but it's not a mass grave of people that were infected. It's a mass grave of people who probably weren't infected. And this hits Ellie hard because this is kind of the side of something like this, like this horrible tragedy across the world that people didn't know how to deal with it and they panicked and things went really bad. And only someone like Joel, who remembers living through this, could recap what this actually is. And this is something that Ellie definitely hasn't come across before, you know, unlike not knowing the science of like what kind of happened or the supposed science of what might have happened. You know, this is definitely something that would be or would have been new to someone like Ellie, who was essentially born during all of this and didn't realize how bad it was and how violent people got towards each other, even when no one was sick.
I think up until this point, the show is not quite dancing around, but hinting at the idea of like, is Fedra a necessary evil? Are they just necessary? Is it like a requirement that to function in a world like this, you need a strict military government type thing? Or are they actually just monsters who have, you know, used their power to take control of the situation and are using it to their own advantage? And Ellie, having kind of been raised by them, as we understand it, I think, is probably a little bit more in favor of them than Joel is, certainly, given how his first interaction with Fedra went with Sarah. And so I think opening Ellie's eyes to that is also part of her character growth to some extent. It's kind of hard to say because it's not something really dealt with a lot in the game. But I think Craig Mazin perhaps has got a lot of things to say about police and their role in society.
I mean, we definitely see this as a reaction of fear, you know, like that, you know, a society terrified does these drastic, horrible things. But then again, like, so as I was watching it with Marco, my husband, he mentioned, he was like, whoa, what an episode to release around Holocaust Remembrance Day. And I was like, oh my gosh, like that is so impactful. And then I was thinking about that and I said to him, I'm like, I wonder if it's actually a good thing to have released something like this around then, because as opposed to saying or thinking that that is a other problem, that is only like a problem from people who had a certain religion, who were Jewish, and you know, that happened to them. This TV show is putting it in the guise of this could happen to anyone, regardless of your religion, of your race, of your, you know, of your
infected
gender
status.
Like, it's like it didn't matter who you were. They were taking people out in these mass graves just because there was no room in the quarantine zones. And so it wasn't about like who you were. It just happened. And so I was like, maybe this could also give some people some empathy of like, you know, thinking about Holocaust remembrance of like, this could happen to anybody under the right horrible, awful circumstances. So, you know, that was something else to like a whole nother level to think about this episode that I didn't even start considering until he mentioned that.
Absolutely horrifying. The people that are in power in The Last of Us and, you know, going back to World War II, the people who tend to be in power tend to be a little bit quicker to a survival of the fittest. We need to save ourselves. We need to do anything that it takes to keep at least me and my immediate circle alive, which means killing a bunch of people from rural communities that can't fit in the QZ. Sorry, you're just potential infecteds later on down the line. Therefore, mass grave. Absolutely horrifying. And you know, after such a heavy scene like that, I'm extremely glad that we take a nice chill detour back to 2003 for a very, very lighthearted montage of a guy just like playing around with tools. Smash cut to 2003. We see two sets of bones wearing like a little white spotted rainbow clothing and then a green blouse. Cut to immediately those characters. We see them being evacuated by Fedra.
Oh my God, I'm so glad we didn't follow that truck. Like, I was like, please don't let me see this mass murder of these people. Like, I can't
absolutely
do it.
It would have been too difficult. And I think one of the nice things about Craig Mazin is that he knows how far to go to make a viewer like appreciate what's happening without being gratuitous about it. This happened in Chernobyl and it happened in this scene too. We didn't follow the truck, thank God.
Yeah, it's like we can all imagine, like we all know what happened here.
There's one person who is not being added to the truck, and that is Bill, played by Nick Offerman. Did you know this would be Nick Offerman's episode when you pushed play? Because I was genuinely surprised when he showed up this early in the series.
Yeah, no, I knew this was coming.
Yeah, so one surprise, one not surprise. I mean, I knew he was in it because I saw cast list, but like I completely forgot about the character of Bill, and it wasn't until after this episode that I went back and rewatched the gameplay with Bill and realized, like, you know, the similarities and the extreme differences where this episode went, which I love where this episode goes. Love, but like hurt. Anyway, we're gonna get into it, but yeah, the appearance of Nick Offerman coming up from that bunker, he's such a prepper. Like, he enters this scene like Ron Swanson, like, you know what I mean? Like, he is Nick Offerman. Like, he is himself as he emerges from this secret bunker after the military has evacuated everyone else. I love it. Such a surprise.
Yeah, my opening statement on Nick Offerman is that he's really leaning into the, like, playing against stereotype of Ron Swanson ever since Parks and Rec ended. He was on Devs. He was great in that. He was in a bunch of other things. He hosted, I believe, a reality show. And this is kind of his first return to that Ron Swanson character that I can think of, only to subvert it extremely and play against type while also doing what he's really, really good at in terms of, you know, bringing this kind of character to life. I thought it was incredible. Ben, do you have an opening statement before we jump on in?
I think similarly, his role as Ron Swanson is almost shorthand for his character in this. You kind of just go into it and like, you don't need any more backstory than this. He's got a basement full of guns and you're like, okay, yeah, I think I know the kind of character Nick Offerman is playing here.
I mean, he has his own like giant woodworking company, so he is still kind of himself, like the Nick Offerman part of himself.
Yeah, kind of perfect for everything that is being set up by the show. You write shorthand for what you can expect from this character. You don't have to have too much of him being Nick Offerman. You kind of know what to expect as someone who is, you know, literate of any of the media happening in 2023. Not today, you new world order jackboot F's. I thought that was a funny line. Watching it with subtitles for the second time, you see that there's people above him saying, oh, no, we're in the basement. There's no one here. This house is empty. And then you realize he's under the basement. I thought that was a cool little touch. He goes outside, gas mask in equipped with a gun out. He's entirely alone in this town, which leads to a very fun montage of him looting Home Depot and the gas station and the liquor store. I love seeing
stealing
him,
his neighbor's boat.
The boat was great.
I'm convinced there was a better trailer somewhere around there. I mean, rural America, I feel like there's a lot of pickup trucks and trailers.
I don't know. I can't think of a more fun trailer than stealing your neighbor's
boat. The boat was great. Practical, though?
Steve, I'm taking your goddamn boat.
It's also like, I feel like in that kind of suburban American town, having a boat is a little bit of a flex on your neighbors. Like, hey, what's up, Nick Offerman? I got a boat. But the fact
especially
that he
in Pennsylvania
it...
where are you taking that? That's a lake boat. Like,
the fact that Nick Offerman wanted it for himself when there was no one around to impress him, that tells me he genuinely wants to be on a boat, which I think is a not uncommon thing in the world of people that own boats that want to kind of one up their neighbors.
I don't know if you ever watched the Walking Dead spin-off Fear the Walking Dead.
No, I haven't.
But it's one of the, I think early in the first season, one of those constant things where you're like, oh, if there was a zombie apocalypse, wouldn't you just like get to the coast, get on a boat and go find an island somewhere, live out your days, you know, eating coconuts or whatever. And the characters find this lovely luxury yacht and they get onto it. And then like the next episode, or maybe even the end of that episode where they find the boat, you realize that because the zombies are undead in that world, they can just float through the water, bump into your boat and start climbing on it. Or I think one gets caught in the, you know, in the engine and in the propellers. And you're like, okay, yeah, water, not a great zombie deterrent if they are incapable of dying.
Yeah, I've never seen The Walking Dead. I think it's interesting that they took that, I was about to call it mechanic, like it's a video game, that thing about the zombies that they, you know, establish in the show, then kind of take it to the next extreme. Like, what if they were in water? They would just float. Oh my God, yeah, that's perfect. And then turn it into a plot point for the show. I think that's really clever. At the end of this montage, he gives himself a quiet steak dinner with some great wine. This is kind of the first foreshadowing that he has, in addition to this big tough guy persona, a very delicate and deliberate touch to how he cares for himself, how he cares for his food, how he prepares everything. He has a little bit of a like food YouTuber moment as he's like, you know, cooking the steak and pouring off the sauce. I thought that was very cute. And as he does this, he is watching a zombie get shot by one of his tripwires. It reminded me of the Saw 2 gun trap for anyone that watched those crappy Saw movies. It says, this doesn't get old. I thought that was a cute way to establish the first 3-4 years of the, you know, isolation and zombie apocalypse from this point to the next smash cut we get. Anything else to add about the first Nick Offerman segment?
TV options are a lot more limited post-apocalypse.
I love how he breaks into the gas company and turns the gas on. He has this all down. He's ready. There is so... I love a good, like, you know, Mighty Duck style improvement montage. And this is like the zombie apocalypse prepper version of that. And I'm here for every second of it. I love this part. And I love how this whole episode brings us on this really amazing journey by this series of flashbacks that keep getting closer and closer to present day. And the way that this is all done, as opposed to a jumping back and forth a lot with like, oh, let's look at in the past. Now let's, you know, look where Ellie and Joel are. You know, we have a big time to really endear ourselves to this character. And knowing that who this character was in the game, like essentially an NPC guide to get you through to find this car battery, and battle zombies together, and then who we get to see fleshed out as a fully formed character and an idea, and yet still true to like the essence of what this character was established as in the game, is just, it is so great. It's almost like we could have an entire series about Bill. If we had the time, you know, like there would be a spinoff show about like Bill's years and we would get like the full thing. And I would totally watch that. But I understand why we don't, because we do have to move on, because it's not a show about Bill, except it is an episode about Bill. But yeah, I love seeing him establish his town and how he is about being alone for that long. And so we do flash forward and find out that in the beginning here, he is alone for 3 years.
I made a note when he was doing all his prepper stuff and building his fences and harvesting his carrots and stuff. It's like, he's living his best life. And then Frank arrives on the scene and you're like, oh no, now he's living his best life. And then he meets Joel and Tess and you're like, okay, no, he's, you know, he's opening up, he's meeting new people. And then at the end of the episode, you're like, ah, he really did live his best life. And it got progressively better. He's the one person who the apocalypse just suited to a T.
It suited him well, and there's a bit at the end of the episode that really made me think about COVID especially, but I like the idea of making sure that when we see this character, they see it through to the end of 20 years worth of media, that he is still himself. At the end in 2023, I'm sure he's still, you know, futzing with trip wires and reinforcing his fences and refilling his gas tanks, but we don't see any of that because that's not what's important then. We need the new information of how he takes care of Frank. We'll get to that in a second. Suddenly, it is 2004, and I love a meet cute and a pit outside. That's a nice little trope that happens is, you know, someone falls through a pit and they meet and it's cute. No, Frank, played by Murray Bartlett, shows up and has not eaten for 2 days and is asking for a meal. And the reason why Nick Offerman doesn't want to give him any food is because every bum you talk to about this is going to show up here wanting a free lunch. And this isn't an Arby's. Ben, have you ever been to an Arby's?
No, I've not been to an Arby's.
It's an American Arby's
is my... pulling apart all my limited American experiences.
Arby's is my favorite fast food, hands down. I went to Arby's on Mother's Day. Like, let me just say. It is so stupidly good. It's the best place to stop on a road trip. But yeah, I know what... I agree with Frank. They do not give away free lunch. You do have to pay for Arby's.
It's a restaurant, literally. And he pays by, you know, offering companionship, and it's great. I also need to stop calling out when Nick Offerman brings ladders to people, because, of course, it reminds me of the video game. But as we come out, you can kind of see this flip in Bill as they're having this conversation. And you're like, okay, fine, just come on in. I'm very lonely. I don't think he realizes that the problem is he's lonely. He's probably reinforcing to himself how happy he is to be alone, that there's no one around him to keep his, like, to get in the way of his survivalist instincts. I bet before the apocalypse happened, there were people in the neighborhood. Like, yeah, there's a lot of, like, welding happening late at night as Frank, or as Bill builds this bunker. We really need to talk to the HOA about this. I'm sure he's trying to convince himself that this is the best of all worlds and not to let anyone else in to mess that up. But he gives it a shot. And rather than just throwing out rations to him like we saw Joel do for Ellie earlier, he brings him inside, gives him clothes, lets him take a shower, cooks him one of his fancy meals with fancy wine. I loved seeing him just be really, really sweet about this in a way that we hadn't seen yet.
I really liked how, for somebody who was pointing a gun at Frank for most of the time that they were on screen during this opening sequence, just how disarmed he was by Frank. Like, Bill is clearly the one in control of the situation, and yet he just, he looks like a deer in the headlights. Like, the one thing he wasn't prepared for was just this nice, normal dude showing up on his doorstep.
I was terrified during all of these scenes. I was so, I got this vibe of not trusting anyone. Maybe that's The Walking Dead rubbing off on me, because you can't trust anyone who's nice in that show. Like, they will kill you in the middle of the night. And so I was going off of those kind of lessons that I learned from watching other TV shows, that, like, someone is not to be trusted. Something horrible is going to happen. Someone's going to turn on someone else. Someone's going to be using their, you know, people skills to be nice for a second, get what they want, and then go straight to some sort of murder. Like, I was on edge this entire time. Like, up until the next flash forward, I thought something horrible was going to happen every single step of the way. I did see, like, I did see kind of, like, how they were slowly bonding and, like, feeling each other out and, like, you know, trying to work through this. And also, like, I think it was also the characters learning to trust each other that gave me, like, an edge to it. But I was just like, oh my gosh, someone's going to kill this nice man. He set up this, like, really nice, beautiful place, and this, like, creep is going to come by and murder him and, like, use him, his vulnerability, and, like, eat his food and then take over everything. Like, I don't know. Like, I was just expecting some sort of psychopathic moment to happen, but I'm so glad it didn't. And I was able to breathe after they finally did the flash forward episode. And then I was really able to think about what I just watched and kind of, like, appreciate their post-apocalyptic meet cute. But yeah, I was terrified during the whole thing.
I agree. There was enough tension there to kind of make you wonder what was going to happen, why Frank is being so nice to him. I think that when we start to see, like, okay, here's your food, here's your wine, we know that this is something that that Bill loves to do because he does it for himself. Of course he wants to flex his cooking muscles for someone that is showing up and kind of offering him some new interesting social experiences he hasn't had in many, many years. I also think this is the first, until, you know, they sit down and start playing the piano and you know, have their very sweet scene, I think that this is the first time we get to see some of the intimacy between the two of them in a way that has no shame wrapped around it. And this is what everyone in my house picked up on in watching this. This is in 2007 in the world of the show, but kind of frozen around the time period of 2003 in the real world. There was no queer media made around this time that didn't involve shame of some kind. This is around when Brokeback Mountain came out, where it's like, oh, I can't, but I can, but I must, but I can't. It was so amazing to see something set around this time period, divorced from the context of the rest of the media that just simply can't exist in a zombie apocalypse, where after they establish that they are attracted to each other, there is no shame about being gay written into the show. I think that's one of the very, very special things about this whole episode.
Especially for older men, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I think that was a fabulous point to make, and that's something, you know, as a straight lady, I saw that throughout all of media, and hearing that from others, I can really appreciate and respect that media has been changing in that way and making it into just a love story. And I think that that is great. And like, honestly, thinking about the way it relates back to the game and the character of Bill and how he had a partner, the game doesn't treat it shamefully either. I think it's just a piece. It's like a fact in the game, as this survivalist is helping Joel and Ellie find this battery and get this car. It's just like who this character is. There's nothing really more attached to it as a, I just had this other person in my life and we had a fight and like we essentially broke up and like went our own ways in the game. Mm-hmm. But so I like to reflect that, like, it's nice that they didn't fix, I don't know, from my perspective anyway, like, it seems like they didn't have to fix any of those mistakes from the game. We have, like, just kind of an average relationship here that happens to be gay.
Mm-hmm.
in both situations. And I love seeing that, and I love it.
It was really fascinating as well. I don't know if you've seen much of Murray Bartlett and other things, but... He is a gay actor, and I think everything I've seen him in, he's played a gay or bi man at least. And like White Lotus, the first season of that, and Welcome to Chippendales, which Sarah and I watched about a week ago. So that's kind of like very in character for his characters. But Nick Offerman playing the vulnerability and the intimacy of that felt very unexpected. I mean, I knew the characters and the roles they were going to play, but it was just weird, good kind of weird seeing him in that way.
Mm-hmm. He's such a good actor. Like I was just blown away by his performance. I think he's just really touching and well done. I think that in a lot of his roles, he really like takes on these characters and becomes them, and this was no different. And I really like seeing him this way. And I was also like, the like kind of scared part of me was like, are all of the people who are like the hyper masculine preppers, like, you know, gay haters out there seeing this icon of masculinity and, you know, wood chopping prepper stuff, like all that, like rawr, associated with all of that, going to see this character, and is there going to be some backlash from it? Like, are those people watching this show that they think that they're getting like the let me hack your face off zombie apocalypse, and they didn't know they were going to be getting so many feelings and they're going to be mad about this? Part of me was like a little bit scared of that, you know, homophobic backlash that comes out in this, even though I know it's been like so many years and it's 2023. We all know that all still exists out there. So I was curious what you all think about that a little bit, because it put me on edge. I'm always just like a little bit worried, even though, like you said, this relationship, it's not about fear and it's not about shame. And that's how the show shows it. But what's the audience going to say?
I had that thought as well. And while I have absolutely no desire to see any of that backlash.
Oh, I agree.
It is very funny to imagine the reactions of some of those people during this.
Yeah, I almost thought so too. I was almost like, stick it to you. Like,
hang on a second. Where's the shame in this relationship? I want to see shame for the gays.
Yeah, that's what they're mad about. They're mad about the shame. There's exactly. No shame.
My favorite tweet I saw about this after we watched the episode was Kate Leth tweeted, "Finally, San Junipero for men." And yeah, I think that's kind of what this is. It's like a very sweet, wholesome relationship. And the fact that I didn't see any backlash, knock on wood, from San Junipero many years ago when that first came out, I think the overwhelming response to this from at least the people I follow is positive. And I think the people, again, maybe I'm just naive, maybe I'm just gullible, but the people that have those homophobic feelings at least can read the room and not contribute that to the conversation. But of course, you know, check me in 24 hours when one of the giant, you know, media things posts a headline that's like, "The Last of Us is gay, really the point of the show," or whatever, like some stupid headline.
Yeah, I'm so insulated from a lot of that, like, hate talk because I just, like, mute it all, you know? So that's why I was, like, curious of how aggressive this might be, because we're talking about a group that is, you know, I don't want to say inherently homophobic, but inherently homophobic, but has those ideals and tendencies, and, like, you know, it's like the people that stormed the Capitol. Like, that's who, you know, I get fearful of.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a difficult square to circle for the audience of the show, but I think this is, like, the smart person's, you know, zombie show where people can come and say, oh, I'm bringing some empathy to this.
This is the zombie show for the intellectual in your life.
Emotionally mature apocalypse.
So they go over to the piano. Frank sees it and says, oh, it's vintage. Oh, that's beautiful. I'd love to play. Oh, this must be your mother's music or something. Oh, no, this is you. Pulls out the Best of Linda Ronstadt and plays Long, Long Time, where the episode comes from, the episode title comes from. I love that Frank is not very good at playing it. He does just kind of a sight reading and stumbles a little bit. And then Nick Offerman stops and says, no, please, not this song. And then kind of sits down and plays a softer, tender version of that song in response, kind of like in conversation with Frank's version, which leads to the indelible, who's the girl you're singing about? There is no girl, which kicks off their romance. Yeah, very, very sweet moment. I think I knew what was coming at this point in the process. I was scared something bad would happen still until, like you mentioned, when they jumped to 2010 and they're just doing a very real couple argument about how to spend their resources. I thought that was very, very sweet. Frank wants to beautify the house and the street a little bit more because he lives here too. And he wants to kind of convince Nick Offerman that this is worth it. The key line from this scene, the government are all Nazis. Yeah, now, but not then. Well, maybe even. And then, too. I want that GIF, and I want it to be widely circulated.
No doubt that'll happen within days.
No, I love the breaking of the tension from this flash forward. It allows you to kind of, like, really settle into their relationship and just appreciate, like, these two people trying to build a life for themselves in this world where life has been taken away from so many. And they are here, they're insulated, they're together, and they are just being totally normal. I love the chill parts of this episode. And I also love the dramatic parts because it makes you feel so very, very deeply.
There is a little bit of whiplash going from that, like, that intimate scene with the piano and the kiss, and then they're in bed, and then all of a sudden they're fighting. Like, okay, yes, there's been a 3-year gap. I have just read that, but it also feels very sudden.
But it's like cute fighting. It's like, I want to
decorate. Yeah, they're
bickering about decorating. No, it's resource management. You know, like, I think it's a cute fight.
It's funny to me that the quiet moments of the episode are the ones where I'm ugly sobbing. And the one moment where they kind of argue and have a loud conversation is where I kind of, oh, thank God, whew, relax. Because we know that, you know, this is a, you know, standard couple argument. It was a very sweet thing to see them actually, you know, have this conversation without being scared of something awful, awful happening, because it's just, you know, relatively inconsequential. You're right. It's resource management. We're trying to figure out how to spend this time and energy. Frank says paying attention to things is how we show love, and he wants to pay attention to the place where they are. And I think that struck a nerve with Bill, because he pays attention to the traps and the fence and the food and the, you know, way that he takes care of Frank, even if he tries not to show it to the outside world. Because as soon as Frank mentions wanting to bring some friends over, he says there are no friends out there to be had. But there's a really nice lady on the radio, which winds up being Joel and Tess. I love that they showed up this early in the episode in the middle of the flashback. I thought the age makeup was interesting because this is the first time we've seen them any time between 2003 and 2023. What do you think of that, their makeup?
I didn't pay too much attention to their makeup, at least for Bill and Frank, until the end of the episode where they're obviously aged up quite a bit older. I did love getting to see a younger Tess here in this part of the show. Because in the two episodes we did see her in, she is obviously kind of aged up a bit. They've made her look a bit bulkier, older.
She's also just coming from getting, like, beat the crap out of.
So it's nice to see her looking kind of, like, fresh and youthful. And I don't know, there's
Tess.
A bit more of a sense of, like, oh, it's Tess and Joel have kind of a new romance or whatever is going on between them. Whereas, you know, when we see them in quote-unquote modern day, it's much more comfortable, settled in with each other, I guess.
they're still hardened from, you know, what they go through and the fact that they're smugglers, and they're using this as kind of like a little garden party, but also connections to getting resources. But we haven't seen them to be like hopeless yet. You know, like, mm-hmm. I feel like when we meet them in the beginning of the series, they're hardened and downtrodden, you know, like at this point when they're with Bill and Frank, they're not downtrodden yet.
There's still new possibilities of like,
yeah,
how are we going to live in this new world and who are we trading with and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Bill has a gun out at the table, which I found very funny, because at any other time in history, that would be extremely uncomfortable to have a gun out at the table. Tarantino does it all the time in all of his movies, but because everyone there is so used to guns on them all the time, they're just like, Bill, you can put that down. It's fine. And you can see him kind of recoil, like, oh, I thought this would be a big tense scene, but honestly, I'm just being taken to task by my partner and his new friends. I thought that was extremely funny that he put it away. But Joel says, you know, I'm the same. I'm also extra careful. I'm not schizophrenic. But I am paranoid about people that may want to kill us. But you're right, they use this as a bit of a networking opportunity back when they probably did, you know, door-to-door kind of, hey, we're smugglers, you should talk to us about something that you might need smuggled in or out of your location. The other thing that hit me in the scene was, how nice is it to have a civilized meal in a beautiful place? That kind of hit me for COVID times too, where the first time you eat in a restaurant after like mm-hmm. a big isolation, it's like, oh, this is so nice to have someone bring you the food and you can just ask for what you want and they bring it to you. That's something that I felt the first time I ate in a restaurant in like 2 years at that point whenever I had that restaurant.
Also very specifically, sitting outside. You know, when restaurants first started out, you weren't eating in the restaurant, you were eating in like a little gazebo or the backyard or whatever.
Mm.
Bill seems to have intentionally, like, that was his compromise with Frank of like, okay, we could have them over, but only outside. We won't let them in the house. And then the first opportunity, Frank's like, come on in the house. I'll show you some stuff. Like, and I think that annoys Bill endlessly. And I thought that was really very funny kind of couple thing. It's like, we talked about this. Like, you know, it was really good. But we also get in this scene that Joel... We have the scene setting, like the opportunity of Joel telling Bill, like, hey, there are going to be raiders coming to this. Like, don't think that you're so off the grid that no one knows you're here. People will find this and they will set up a plan to try and get here and get your resources. So, like, you know, Joel sets that up for Bill. And so we know that at least he knows that there are still, you know, some really scary things about outside. And I think that's the point where we see a little bit more, you know, reinforcement montage where he adds some traps. Don't we see him doing that later on?
Mm-hmm.
In kind of like response to what Joel had told him.
There's some more great little bits with Joel in this scene as well, where he's saying in the quarantine zone, we've got books and medicine and machine parts. Machine parts are one of the collectibles in the game. If you want to upgrade yep. your gun to be 10% faster at reloading or whatever. He does a little construction corner where he's like, your fence is starting to rust. You know, you got to replace that with aluminum wire. And you're like, okay, yeah, he's got a background in construction. That's good. Mm-hmm. Checking that box. And then there's also this tiny little moment where he is about to refer to Tess. And he goes, my, and you're like, is he going to say girlfriend, partner, friend? And he just goes, mine. She's just mine. I can't think of a better word.
We get criminally little Tess and Frank interaction in the show, because every time we see them talk, they're just having a grand old time. They're coming up with the song code that we see in the first episode. They're talking
yes,
about
I
like
love
exchanging
so
and bartering.
Much.
So cute. I loved it.
I didn't catch that the first time. It was only after I had subtitles on and I was like, oh, they're setting that up.
Yeah, I love that they established that right then. That's so great. And yeah, you're like, oh, okay, now we're all connecting. Here we go. This is who the code is with, because we didn't know that before.
No, exactly. And Ellie says Bill and Frank in that first episode, but you don't make that connection until, oh, yeah, this episode, Bill and Frank, the songs, once they mention that they're making this new code. Mm-hmm. Smash cut to 2013. Of course, every relationship has to have one of either the jogger or the one that stockpiles guns and sulfuric acid. Of course, we all have that in our relationships. The strawberries. All I have written for this scene is the strawberries with a sobbing emoji. Very cute. Very sweet. Watching Nick Offerman act and Murray Bartlett act like they have never had a strawberry in the last 10 years. Oh, God, I loved it.
Nick Offerman's giggle after he has that bite is just, oh, I was not expecting that.
Melted my heart.
I love that he was also like, not on the strawberries.
Listen, there's plenty of places around here we can do it. The strawberries is not one of them.
There was two lines as well in this scene, and I was just like, I feel like these are some of like the best writing of, you know, single lines in anything, and there's two of them in this one scene together. Bill, Nick Offerman says, "I'm sorry for getting older faster than you."
Ugh.
And you're like, oof, that, you know, in a world where these are just two people, they've got almost nobody else except for, I don't know, visits from Joel and Tess every couple of months, maybe. And then, "I was never afraid before you showed up." And you're just like, this is a guy who's probably not super expressive when it comes to sharing his feelings. Both of those lines coming out of him, you're just like, this is a real moment for him.
And I don't know if you've seen True Detective Season 1, which I loved to death when it first came out. I haven't seen it since. There is a scene in there with like a big police raid where it's very dark and there's lots of explosions and things going off. That's exactly what this next raid scene reminded me of. It is nighttime. Murray Bartlett wakes up and sees that there's, you know, fire going off and there's gunfire outside. It is, I guess, Nick Offerman's like gas flamethrower traps, you know, torching everybody. But he runs out, grabs a gun, and Nick Offerman's standing there alone with a sniper rifle shooting people, picking them off, and it's very macho, very, very like grand, and "I will save you, Frank," and everything. And we have this incredible, like, beautiful horizon of fire that Frank has, or that Bill has built to keep everyone out there and safe. But Bill gets shot. Frank brings him back inside. Amazingly, Frank also didn't get shot, but I guess at that point everyone was torched alive. Wow, what an incredible scene where the set design and the like Kevin McAllister trap design is kind of secondary to these two people's incredible performance of, we're going to take care of each other, we're going to make sure each other are safe.
I loved how this was shot. The cinematography, the lighting, all that was great. The silhouettes of people running through the fire. It was the one scene in the whole show, the whole episode, that didn't quite land for me.
Tell me why.
Part of it was because, like, I almost wanted to see more of it. You know, Bill's kind of signature thing is that he builds all these traps, and we kind of see a few of them. But I'm like, I do want to see that Home Alone, like, 10-minute sequence of just watching people be maimed in terrible ways.
Okay, yeah, I have a different reason, but go ahead, finish yours.
That was part of it. I was just like, you know, so much was set up of, like, he builds all these traps, whatever. And then Joel warning him, it's like, raiders are going to come. So they're kind of building up that tension. I wanted more of that payoff, I suppose. And then the other thing was just Bill standing in the middle of the street shooting.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
that.
He's the prepper. He's the gun nut. Surely, surely he would have thought this out better. He would have better places to hide.
Yes.
He
would have
traps.
A sniper's nest. He would have a nest to, like, hide himself in. He would have a cover. I mean, any hunter knows you have a cover. Like, Oh my gosh.
And also because he was so, like, enthralled with what was happening, I'm sure maybe this is, like, only the second or third time this trap has gone off. I bet he read the situation, said everyone's being torched. He wants to go out and play Rambo and stand in the street and shoot everyone. That didn't feel out of character for him necessarily, but you're right. He probably has a sniper's nest somewhere a little bit more secure when he feels more threatened. I don't think he felt threatened in that moment.
I can get an argument that he was, like, you know, overcome with adrenaline and he wants to protect Frank, so he is just out there gunning people down. On the other hand, it's like, he's got something to lose now. You know, he's got a life worth living. Surely he would feel more defensive in that regard.
Yeah, that was the one thing, like, that pulled me out of the emotions of this scene, because I think everything else is so great. Like, I wouldn't change anything else besides giving him, like, a tipped over car to cover behind. Like, anything that he could have, like, I know they cleaned up the neighborhood, but, like, anything, any kind of hide, any kind of blind that he would be in to protect himself even just a little bit. Because, like, if you're going to be able to keep shooting people, you have to not get shot. So, mm-hmm. like, yeah, that was the one thing that I felt was, like, extremely out of character. I know they had to, like, get him to get shot, but I still think he could have been accidentally shot even if he were hiding. Like, he just could have right. been...
There could have been one guy who flanked him, or a bullet could have gone through a car. Whatever.
Yes, it's like something else
if
unexpected.
If they had just made an effort.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, I agree. If he
obviously,
was just,
a
like,
lot of effort went into the show, but that one thing.
Yes, that one thing. One thing. But then afterwards, when he does get shot, I kind of like let it go. And the whole scene with, you know, Frank taking care of him on the table and, you know, Bill getting ready essentially to die and telling him where all the codes were and the notes and to contact Joel, you know, that was all chef's kiss. That was all really well done with the fire in the background behind the windows. Like it was intense. I thought this was the end of Bill.
I love as well how Frank was paying no attention whatsoever to his plans and his instructions. He was just like, that's nice, dear. You know, whatever makes you comfortable as I pull a bullet out of you or whatever's going on. It's just like, call Joel. And he's like, I'm just going to do whatever.
And then to flash forward to the wheelchair on the porch and it be Frank in the wheelchair. Oh, my gosh. Right? Isn't that when this happens?
Mm-hmm. The jump cuts in this episode are just never quite what you expect them to be.
Yeah. I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
You're used to 3 or 4 years at a time, and then suddenly 10 years later, we're in 2023. Here, Ben Tiff, sorry, it looks like you dropped your disbelief. Let me put that back up there and suspend it again for you. Okay, and we're back. So it's the last act of the Ben and the... You're Ben. It's the last act of the Bill and Frank story. And God, everyone have their tissues ready because this is where I really got devastated. The one thing I'll say is that I give the old age makeup like an 8 out of 10. Frank, great job. Especially because he's sick. I think they did a good job there. Nick Offerman, I think the white mustache looked a little silly on him, but then I forgot about it almost instantly.
I was completely totally makeup blind to all of it. Usually I'm super critical of like wigs and makeup and facial hair, you know, fake stuff and everything with their spirit gum. But like this, I was completely blind to it because I was so caught up with like being shocked from what we just saw in the last scene. And then the jump cut to this and what's happening now. Like this has been so long and the emotion between the two of them. Oh my gosh, it just tore me apart. I couldn't even look at the makeup really. Like, I was all blurry anyway. I couldn't see. Mm-hmm. My eyes were watery.
Maybe that's why they did the makeup the way that they did, because everyone...
Yeah, they're like, no one's going to notice. Nobody's going to know.
Frank has taken up painting. It's clear he has some form of cancer or some other like debilitating disease that, with modern medicine and with maybe a door-to-door MRI salesman, he could survive. But it seems like at this point, they're just in survival mode, making him comfortable mode. This is a moment where we've kind of stopped seeing Frank, Bill doing all the traps and things and doing all that. But we know in the background he's still, you know, maintaining his bunker, maintaining the fences and things like that.
What we do see of Bill still doing is he's watering the flowers for Frank, like showing that like, hey, I still care about things being beautiful for you. Even though Frank isn't the one that can still do it, he's like watering the mums outside of his art studio. I was like, oh, that just like really got me. I'm going to get teary-eyed thinking of it right now. I am. I'm going to lose it.
In the previous scene with the Raiders, when Frank wakes up, you know, he runs downstairs, he grabs the gun. You're like, you get the sense that Bill has been training him for this kind of moment, and he's internalized that. Like, he's not panicking, he knows what to do. And then in this scene, you're like, this is where Frank has been training Bill. What are the plans to make everything nice? So, like, they've really rubbed off on each other.
That's heartbreaking, Ben. Jesus. And that's the thing, right? Over time, over 20 years or 15 years, these people... when you're in a relationship for that long, you kind of become a little bit more of an average of the two of you. You start to absorb and give traits of yourself to the other person. The cute names for the pills, one orangey, one whitey, one big roundy. This made me realize how many silly words Truge and I have developed over the pandemic together just because we're the only people talking to each other. We have Nuggies for chicken nuggets.
Say Nuggies too.
McDonald's is the Scottish restaurant. A few times when I'm in polite company, I will say, oh yeah, we had Nuggies yesterday. And I'll wait, that's not... People get what I mean, but that's like a Truge and Brianism. Do either of you have like cute language things like this that you have with your partners?
So many, and most of them relate to the cat.
Yeah, absolutely. We have like weird words for all kinds of stuff or little shorthands. And yeah, actually with my son, we say nugs or nuggies. And now Marco starts saying nugs and nuggies. It's just funny because it feels out of character coming from him, but because I know it's not what he would do, but that's the language that the two of us use. So he just kind of is like, all right, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, Borgor became the word for burger somehow in the house. I don't quite know, but this is how you know they thought about how they're spending their time together and how their language has grown and changed, especially for something as...
I would like to propose an episode of Top 4 Nuggies, Tiff.
There's dino nuggies, there's mushroom nuggies. Oh, watch out for those mushroom
nuggies. Don't eat the mushroom nuggies. For something as difficult to handle as these pills, I can see how they made something cute out of it, and I thought that was great. Tender, sweet, heartbreaking, gentle. I just have a list of adjectives. In the morning, Frank is in the wheelchair, and Bill is freaking out because his feet will turn blue if he's in the wheelchair for too long. He's not going to fall asleep because it's his last day. And as soon as Frank says it, you can tell Bill and Frank have had this conversation a lot over the last few years, and they know that when they say that phrase, years of emotions are flooding back to them and all the plans that they have made are flooding back to them. Who's coming, Bill? The door-to-door MRI salesman. I love that. And nice little bit of levity in the middle of this. And then they have a normal day. They walk around and wheel him around and enjoy the nature. They, you know, sit and relax. It is a normal day that is made all the more beautiful by the fact that it is Frank's last day. I like that they didn't go out of its way to make this day any different than the rest of them until the end.
I'm not sure I agree with that because Frank says, we're gonna go to the boutique shop that I repaired 10 years ago, whatever. I'm gonna pick out something nice for us to wear and we're gonna get married.
Yeah, that like, Frank just really dictates what the day is going to be. He's like, this is how I want my day to be and this is how I want you to love me during this day. And that's
Yes, let me clarify. I mean the shots leading up to that, because when they walk around the, you know, the street, the compound and everything, there's nothing special about those scenes. It's just a simple walk between two people that love each other until the
Before his last day kind
of. Yeah, I mean like the cinematography. Yeah, like the cinematography and the shooting of those scenes are no different than the way that we have treated Bill and Frank in that moment. You're right. The day itself and the plans towards the end are very different and dictated by Frank. But yes, then we get to they get married. They have these suits that look old and ratty because I'm sure they've never worn them. They just kind of had them in the boutique that was fixed up a few years ago. This was particularly hard because yesterday, a few hours before we watched this, Truj and I looked at our first wedding venue potential. So that was a difficult moment for us. Because they got married in their living room on the piano where they first met. They have a nice dinner, fancy dinner. I notice in this scene, Bill is sitting next to Frank and not along the other side of the table from him. Very sweet. He was helping him. He was so sweet.
Did he cook him the same meal from when they first met?
Yeah, with the rabbit, with the wine pairing.
Yeah, it was the same wine. I noticed that Frank got a kick out of that.
Just the idea that, like, you know, they're a couple, they've been together for 15-odd years. Marriage is not, like, an institution that really matters in this world anymore. And the idea that that's what Frank wants to spend his last day doing is magical.
Mm-hmm. It is very magical. It's something that feels extra special for these two people, especially for Bill, who doesn't really do extraneous things just for the sake of aesthetics or emotions.
And especially for a gay couple, because I don't know what the state of gay marriage in America was at that time in that part of America.
Oh my God, you're right. Because it was frozen in time in 2003. I don't even know what gay marriage was like in America in 2003.
I can't say either. But like the way Nick Offerman's character, Bill, obviously, the way Bill handles this situation is so heartbreaking because I'm gonna cry. I'm just gonna cry. I'm crying on the Last of Us podcast. It is like he seems like the type of person that can do anything, that if you ask someone to do something, he does it. Like, can you fix this? Can you find this? Can you make this happen? He can do it. I mean, look at the crazy elaborate prepper bunker he built and established to like not get, you know, deported essentially out of his neighborhood. deported, taken, I don't know, moved to the quarantine zone. Yeah. But it seems like he's so capable. He set up everything. But then when Frank asks him to do these things for him, like to make this last day a last day, that's where he breaks down. He's like, I can't do it. Oh, it's like, that kills me.
It ruined me.
The scene where they're on the couch and he's just like trying to hold it together. Like, I want to do this for you, but I don't know if I can. You're just like, and it's Nick Offerman, the manliest of men. You're just, what more can you say?
But then he, you know, he does it. We see all these, this montage scene of him, like, as we described, like him doing it. Like he persons up and does it, you know, so.
The music as well. Mm-hmm. Max Richter's The Nature of Daylight, which you may recognize from Arrival. Mm-hmm. Just one of those pieces that like cuts you to your core. No matter what it's in, the first couple of notes started playing and I was just like, oh, I recognize this. What? And then I'm like, oh no, it's the one that makes you cry song.
I didn't catch it in the moment, but I saw a friend of mine post on Instagram about it because it's one of their favorite songs. They love Rival. They're like, well, I was already an emotional wreck and now, like Ben, I recognize this song while in the middle of this scene.
I'm old, I'm satisfied, and you were my purpose.
Yeah, I think like when we find out after the dinner and, you know, Frank's request was that he breaks up the pills and allows him to go to sleep. And so he just go to sleep in his arms. Oh, that kills me. Oh, I hit my mic. That kills me too. Like that. Oh, breaks me down so much. But the idea that he would then have to wake up and deal with that in the morning, mm-hmm. I feel like that would have been too much for him. And it kind of informs this decision that he is going to be going with Frank mm-hmm. on this. And it isn't just a, you know, kind of euthanizing situation. It's that Bill is going to be going with him and that like together their lives have been complete and they've done everything they needed to do. And there was really not much more for Bill to continue on with. And I think that that is really very humane. Sorry. So emotional on a podcast. It's hard to convey when you have to speak. Mm-hmm. It's very humane to himself to go with Frank on this last day. You know, like, I don't know if he would have survived much more without him in the way that they were together and what they ended up meaning for each other.
I love that this is a decision that Bill has come to, that, you know, Frank has said, I want you to knock me out with the sleeping drugs so I never wake up. And he's agreed to that. But then hidden to Frank, he's you know, put the drugs into the whole bottle of wine because he wants to go too. Frank realizes this and he's just like, I don't agree with this. Like, I want you to go on living without me, but I understand it and I appreciate it.
And he says it in the way that like he's disagreeing with a decor decision in the house. Nice little moment of levity where the smallest moment of just kind of like cracking a smile and saying, I disagree is heartbreaking.
I almost think that like the, you know, that Bill decided this earlier on than we figured it out as the audience or found out about it, because like otherwise how else would you be able to get through that day unless you knew that it was also your last day? Mm-hmm. And so like if you're doing this together, like you are knowing that like this is our last day, like you almost have more strength to do it than if you know that it's only one person's last day. I don't know. Mm-hmm. This is me.
I also, in a moment of levity, while I was, you know, laugh sobbing, needed to chime in with the Princess Bride quote. Where is the poison? The battle of wits has become. It ends when you decide and we both drink and we find out who is right and who is dead. And just like in the Princess Bride, they are both poisoned. I needed that. Trude did not laugh. I laughed a little. When at the end of this scene, they go upstairs. A few weeks pass,
they don't go upstairs because Frank's in a wheelchair, so they've moved to a downstairs bedroom.
Right. Yes, I did notice that.
I was wondering that because that very, very final scene of the window, which I was terrified they were going to show them both in the bed together. Mm-hmm. I was like, please don't show that. Like, but they didn't. Thank God.
Yeah.
But it was from an upstairs window point of view. So.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
I was just curious of it. But also, Joel couldn't get into the downstairs room. Downstairs, it was locked.
Yeah.
So,
I think they had obviously moved to the downstairs room because Frank was not able for stairs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you're right, Ben.
Yeah, I noticed that too. You're right. Craig Mazin's taste is, you know, going to destroy you emotionally, but not be gratuitous about it. And I thought that was a really nice choice as well. But we learn that as they arrive, the reason why 80s started playing in the first episode, because we never saw them push play, was because after a few weeks, if it's not interacted with, 80s music just starts and kind of broadcasts to Joel and Tess that there is a problem if someone has not been there for a few weeks. Because we were wondering that how the 80s music started playing, if that was the case. They arrive and see the candles burn down to the wicks and melting all over the shelf. We see the food kind of, you know, old and rotten with flies all around it, implying that a bunch of time has passed. The note that Frank left for Joel and Tess, I guess in that sense, is written in a way that an Airbnb host would write a letter to new tenants. So I'm like, hey, welcome. Take anything that you need. Just don't go in the back room. We tried to open the window a little bit to make it less smell. It's so, so heartbreaking and beautiful.
It's like in an Airbnb where they warden off like one closet or cupboard or something. You're just like, that's our stuff. Don't go in there.
It's our stuff. That's where the router is. Please don't mess with it.
It's the owner's closet.
To whomever, but probably Joel made me laugh very hard. Like, they were trying to do the, like, grand writing of the note and everything. But let's be honest, it's probably going to be Joel that's going to read this.
I love that Ellie picked it up and she started reading it. She was like, technically, I'm whoever.
I am whomever. That's who I am for purposes of this.
Another nice video game bit of, like, picking up letters to fill in backstory of the world.
Yep.
I used to hate the world and was happy everyone died, but I was wrong because there was one person worth saving. That's what I did. I saved him. I protected him. That's why men like you and I are here. We have a job to do, and God help any mamacitas who stand in our way. I think that you mentioned, Tiff, earlier that Bill is prepped exquisitely for the zombie outbreak and pandemic and everything. And I think that's part of what this letter is about. I was happy. Everything was fine. And then love happened. And love shows up to challenge people like you and me who have it so good, but have a reason to then focus and love and cherish and become more enamored with the details and less obsessed with making sure the fence is completely perfect or something. And so, therefore, use these supplies to help Tess. And that is where Joel starts to get very emotional. And we get all the way looped back to the end of last episode, Tess kind of passing the baton to Ellie as the person that Joel is focused on saving.
I love this part of the scene, not only for the note and everything and the way Ellie interacts with it and the way Joel reacts to it, but also for that little detail of there's a car key in or next to the letter, and Ellie pushes it across the table and it scrapes up the dust that's on the table. Like, those little visual clues like that of, like, showing how, like, the time that might have been passing, or I should say, sorry, fix this, showing the time that has passed. And it's just, it's such a beautiful little indicator. And we do have that, like, atmospheric feel in this house, and it's a little dusty. It's been closed up for a little while. Like, these two people are going through, and then we get, like, them going through the house after their interaction with the letter. And when they find that box of t-shirts, and Ellie puts on that t-shirt, that's the same shirt that she has on in the game.
Oh, I didn't notice
that. Oh, it was so good. It was so good. It's that, like, maroon shirt with the logo, kind of like the tone-on-tone logo.
Sunset kind of thing, yeah.
Oh, so, so good.
I also loved when Ellie is reading the letter and she reads out Bill's I don't know if you have that feature enabled on your phone, but if you have AirPods in to have Siri read your messages,
yes.
Sometimes Siri comes across things like that that are real, like, not proper words, and she just completely butchers it. It reminded me of that, and I got a good laugh.
It feels like something that someone more online than a 2003 person would do, but I thought it was very funny for, you know, that little moment, because all letter writing etiquette is out the window.
She's also such a snarker.
She's snarky and very funny, but also wanted to, you know, poke fun, like you mentioned, 90s affect of poking fun at people to show affection. They go down into the bunker. Ellie finds a gun because there's so many guns down there. Say, hey, can I? No. Okay. The problem is not that there's a surplus of guns now. It's that Joel doesn't want Ellie to have a gun. They get into the car. It's like a spaceship, which made me think of The Last of Us 2. I thought that was a sweet moment. And she didn't know how to fasten her seatbelt, so Joel had to reach over and buckle it. Very, like, paternal, you know, little kid kind of thing.
We really should mention, though, that Ellie Gratt did find a gun in the desk drawer and quickly put it in her backpack before Joel came down, because she insisted that he take a shower because he stank.
That's a break from the game as well, because she doesn't get a gun until a bit later. I also love finding toilet paper, the most valuable commodity in the post-apocalypse.
Yes, all the things that they choose to. Yeah, all the things that they choose to take and go through. And also we should say that you know, they do get the truck, but the truck had no battery. And they open up. Joel is looking around, very upset to see that the truck had no battery. But then he opens up the refrigerator, and this is something that I didn't know what he was looking at. It was a deconstructed battery that, in order to preserve the lifetime of the battery, it was taken apart so that all the parts wouldn't corrode together to extend its life. Bill had refrigerated it and taken it apart. And so that's why Joel is saying, like, I have a battery prepping in the, and I didn't know any of that. It was Marco who was like, he's like, oh, that's so smart. I'm like, oh my God, thank God you're here and told me that, because I would have had no clue what that was. I was like, why is there C4 in the fridge? Like, I don't know what I would think it was.
I assumed it was the battery in the fridge, but I didn't get the deconstructed part.
Yeah, so
one,
it's like,
the
it
one thing
doesn't
I know
corrode.
Is people put film for cameras in the fridge to preserve its lifespan. So it was like something along those lines.
So I thought that that was like a really cool, very prepper detail that I feel like that community would definitely have known about.
One other thing I thought might happen in the scene is Joel quoting from the game again is like, you can't let anyone find out about your condition. And he asked to see Ellie's arm again, I guess, to check that it hadn't gotten any worse. But at some point between the end of the first game and the start of the second, Ellie intentionally burns her arm with some sort of chemical to disguise the fact that it's a bite from the infected. And right at the opening, when we see Bill in his bunker, we see these jugs of sulfuric acid. And I thought that might be about to happen, that Joel would just be like, here, we need to splash some acid on your arm. Glad we didn't have to watch that, but I don't know, maybe that'll happen at some point.
You know, after all of this, this trek for the battery that happens in the game to then get an episode like this. What was that tweet that you had posted in our chat, Ben? It was the perfect summary of what just went down. The Last of Us writers were like, hey, Joel needs a car. What if we write the most touching and heartbreaking hour of television in the world? Like, that is the perfect summary of it. This was just like the quest for the battery and the car. And it was, that is what like bookended this episode, but everything in the middle, like, you were just emotionally taken on this insane roller coaster and then let off. And we're all like, wait, what were we doing? Where are we? And yet now here we are back on the quest for the battery. And now we have the new quest of finding Joel's brother, because we find out that, you know, Bill and Frank had passed away, and what Joel was hoping to get help from, I guess he did because he got the supplies, but it is now a much longer journey than he thought he was going to have to make.
In the lead up to this episode, I think in the lead up to the show launching altogether, a lot of the journalists, the media people, received the first three episodes to watch. I think some of them received all 10, but I think the majority just received the first three because that is what had been finished editing. And I saw from quite a few that were saying episode 3 is one of the best episodes of television in years. So I had a feeling going into this that it was going to be a good one, but I didn't really know what to expect. And I think it absolutely lived up to the hype. I think, like your comparison, Brian, that you saw earlier to San Junipero, I think this is going to go down as like one of the great standalone episodes of TV of, you know, the last decade, the last 20 years even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, up there with the Doc and Bean episode of Mythic Quest in the first season, where surprise, emotional gut punch in the middle of a silly show about video games. Yeah, I think it was one of the things that when you approach a show like The Last of Us and you need to kind of not beef it up for the TV screen, but add more details that, you know, people that didn't just play the game and not just showing up for the game will want to see, you get a beautiful episode like this where the brainstorm is, hey, how about we use an hour of TV to go into the backstory of Bill and Frank? Yeah, let's do it. That sounds great. And now, thanks to it, I'm sure the Emmys are pulling up a truckload of Emmy awards over to The Last of Us Studios. Neil Druckmann and Murray Bartlett and Nick Offerman, they're all just going to receive their Emmys in the mail from this giant truck. Yeah, any final thoughts about this episode? Because I don't know how much longer I can talk about it without crying.
On the Emmy note, it makes me very sad to think that only one of them could win for Best Supporting Actor. or whatever. There is an award for, like, you know, a small role, isn't there?
Oh, my God. There's, like, a guest actor. And because there are only one episode, I bet they're... But, yeah, you're right. Only one of them can probably win.
I do love that Ellie pulls the tape out of... just like in the game, also. She finds the cassette tape to put into the truck as they're driving away, and it ends up being the song that Bill and Frank were playing on the piano. So
I was wondering about that as well, because it seemed to be a favorite song of both of them. Mm-hmm. And I was like, did Bill already have this tape, or did at some point in the last 15 years he went off and found it in like a nearby town or something? And that was just a happy little thought of a thing that maybe Bill did for Frank, or vice versa, or, you know, maybe it was just around.
Maybe it was like an anniversary gift.
One other thing we need to do before we wrap up is Mushroom of the Week.
Oh, yes. I have a very quick Mushroom of the Week, which is actually like a little icon button. When you Google search for The Last of Us, a little mushroom button comes up on the bottom of the screen, which I was like, what are you? I know we're not supposed to be using Google anymore because of reasons, but like I was, because I'm a trash person. And you click the mushroom button and mushroom fungus bits start growing on your screen. And not just once, you can click that sucker all you want and more spores and mushroomy things start growing across the screen. And I thought that was like a really cool little touch. I've never seen or interacted with anything like that besides this on like on Google or a website. You know, they always do the little they put their logo with like funny little things for
Google Doodle
holidays. Yeah, but I've never seen like a whole screen takeover moment just from a search of a specific franchise or something. So I just thought that was a really cool little tie-in that they did. So Mushroom of the Week, mushroom button on Google. I'm sorry for ruining all of your privacy by making you go use Google and check out this mushroom button, but I'm not going to say it's worth it, but it is fun if you already use it.
I put a link in the show notes to an article about it, and I second this nomination. I think it's fantastic.
Google has plenty of, you know, problematic things with regards to privacy, I guess, but they have always had that little bit of whimsy, I think, like Apple does in many ways, or Apple has had in the past. That, you know, you're like, okay, there are real humans working in this company that have fun and enjoy things that we do as well.
I mean, I can never turn down an Easter egg. I'm a video game person, so.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you, everyone, so much for listening to this episode. We hope that our conversation and catharsis can help you process your own conversation and catharsis about this with the people in your life, because what a difficult episode. This is the best time I've had on Twitter, just reading people's reactions to it in like a year. I think it's been fantastic to be a part of this conversation with my very dear friends, Tiff and Ben. And thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with more Last of Us recaps. Until next time, stay teary-eyed.
No, less crying next time. More shooting.
I'm old, I'm satisfied, and this was my purpose.
Oh!